You have less than 2 weeks to live.
Ali had to hit the right psychological tone to ensure Sebastian believed he was a part of the team and would survive the mission.
At its height, the Soviet State Center for Virology and Biotechnology, also called Vector, was one of the most advanced bioweapons labs in the world. In 1977, Dr. Nikolai Ustinov was injecting Marburg virus into a guinea pig when he accidentally injected the virus into his thumb. The animal was not strapped to a board, and Dr. Ustinov was not wearing the proper biohazard suit or gloves required for the experiment.
Sebastian whispered a prayer to Allah.
As you know, all viruses have unique characteristics. That is what allows us to differentiate them from one another and develop vaccines specific to the particular disease. The more deadly they are, the harder they are to spread, killing their host before they can move on to another body with healthy tissues to destroy. High contagion rates, such as H1N1, flu, and COVID-19, have kill rates between 0.01% and perhaps as high as 0.2% or 0.3%. By contrast, the 1918 Spanish flu and the swine flu in 2009 caused worldwide panics because of the respiratory nature of the spread. Hemorrhagic viruses like Marburg only spread through direct blood-to-blood contact or secretions with broken mucous membranes, making them difficult to transmit. Once contracted, however, Marburg is a true killer, with an infection fatality rate of 85 to 90% and death in 13 days. Forgive me, if it only spreads through blood-to-blood contact, what is all this for?
Sebastian asked, pointing to the equipment he'd so painstakingly prepared over the preceding months.
Because the variant extracted from Dr. Ustinov can be aerosolized. Alhamdulillah, Sebastian whispered. Dr. Ustinov was immediately quarantined in the facility behind pressure-locked doors. As his body and brain liquefied over the next 2 weeks, he kept a diary, documenting the progression of his deterioration. It started with a headache, fever, and nausea, followed by toxic shock as his eyes filled with blood and the capillaries throughout his body began to hemorrhage. Near the end, he was literally bleeding through the pores of his skin, to say nothing of the blood and liquefied organs oozing from his nose, mouth, penis, and anus. The blood and mucus-stained pages were collected and transcribed before being incinerated. When Ustinov's body had nothing more to give the invading filoviruses, when his cells had all burst, he finally succumbed. His body was doused with a chloramine disinfectant and welded into a metal box to seal the deadly African pathogen inside. But not before the Russians took samples from his organs,
Sebastian deduced.
That is correct. Additional testing showed something interesting. Do you know what it was?
Sebastian took a moment before responding.
The virus had adapted. Lab-grown viruses are often more potent than those found in nature. Not only was it more deadly, it was also more stable. They named it Variant U, after its creator. Do you know what they did next?
Sebastian didn't hesitate this time.
They weaponized it. Yes. They weaponized it for an aerosolized delivery via vapor. They tested it on monkeys in a facility in Kazakhstan and on human test subjects in Africa. It became the most potent bioweapon in the Soviet arsenal. And you have it with you? I do. It's time to make a weapon.
Dressed in full level A hazmat suits with respirators, Ali and Sebastian went to work. Ali's hands moved deliberately in the encased glove box as he carefully cut open the bottle of hand sanitizer that he'd received from Hafez Kassem. He slowly extracted a small test tube of plasma under the vented hood. plasma originating in Dr. Ustinov's dead body in 1977. The most deadly pathogen in human history was now in the basement of a rundown house in Denver, Colorado. Over the next 3 days, Ali and Sebastian transferred variant U blood plasma to the cell culture plates in a process called transfection. A virus that had been sitting dormant for decades had been given a host. It had been lurking in the shadows, waiting for its opportunity to multiply. When Ali injected it into the cell culture, the virus was resurrected. The doctor would have liked a real-time X-ray fluoroscopy to confirm the procedure was working, but the samples they observed under the electron microscope indicated it was growing. Within a week, each of the culture discs contained millions of copies of the disease. Variant U had come back to life. Chapter 17. Interstate 90. Reese had never driven from Virginia to Illinois. When he was stationed on the East Coast, he and Lauren had big plans to explore Maine, the Shenandoahs, New River Gorge, the Okefenokee Swamp, and the Florida Keys. Instead, the newlyweds never left Virginia Beach, a series of back-to-back workups and deployments taking precedence. He smiled at the memory of buying their first home together on the water in the seal-dominated Chicks Beach area, and of the night Lauren had shared the news that they were expecting their first child. He thought they would all have plenty of time to travel together. He had been wrong. Lauren and Lucy were dead, murdered, because of a government-private sector conspiracy that Reese had dismantled piece by piece. His wife and daughter had been murdered by the same government Reese now served. "Not forever. I'm going to do this job, get the intelligence from the agency I need to find Nizar Khatan, and put him down, then I'm out." The former SEAL had never been the biggest fan of flying. Even in SEAL training, it had always been a relief when the red light switched to green and the jumpmaster pointed at the exit ramp or door. He'd had to touch down in more than a few airfields that required excessively aggressive landings where there was nothing for Reese to do but brace for impact. That and pray. Reese would much rather be in control of his own vehicle on the open road with access to his weapons. On this particular drive, he needed to think. As the miles clicked by on the odometer of his old 1988 Land Cruiser, Reese attempted to shake the memories of the dead. Lauren had always rolled her eyes at the classic off-road vehicle. She knew that Reese loved the car for some reason, and that it was just part of the package. His old FJ62 had recently been upgraded with a Corvette LS3 engine, giving it more power than most modern trucks and SUVs. From the outside, it looked like a standard 1980s 4x4. That vintage exterior cloaked what was on the inside, an entirely new machine. Restored by the experts at Icon in California, the old truck was a sleeper. Grayman Tactical rigid Molly panels were attached to both seat backs and held a fire extinguisher, medical kit, tourniquet, knife, and Winkler tomahawk. The firearms, conveniently secured to the black plastic panels, had been transferred to Goose Gear Overland storage drawers. Reese had installed them in the back of the vehicle in preparation for his drive to Virginia from Montana, before his clandestine services class had kicked off. It was better to keep the AR, shotgun, and scoped long gun out of sight, even if he did have U.S. Marshals Service credentials in case he was stopped. That was one of his asks of the president. He had once been issued a Marshal's badge as part of an operation on U.S. soil when he was in the SEAL teams. It opened doors and kept the operators out of trouble with local law enforcement in case they were rolled up. U.S. Marshal creds were also federal, meaning he would not have the issues that Texas Rangers Frank Hammer and Manny Gault had when they left the Lone Star State hunting down Bonnie and Clyde. The arsenal that Hammer carried around in the backseat of his 1934 Ford Model 40B in pursuit of the infamous killers actually dwarfed what Reese had hidden in the back of his Land Cruiser. The former SEAL needed to be a bit more subtle.
get in the game, Reese.
He'd been taught the basics of surveillance and surveillance detection routes in the SEAL teams as part of his training in PSD, or Personal Security Detail Operations. His team had been the first tasked with protecting the interim Iraqi government officials after the invasion, a mission most of them thought would be suicide. He had also done some work with the FBI's hostage rescue team on close-target reconnaissance, which included driving into enemy territory to gather intelligence prior to a hit. Reese's troop had two HRT members and two field agents assigned to them in Iraq, investigating connections to planned terrorist operations in the continental United States. Of all the missions Reese had conducted over the years, the ones that gleaned intelligence on threats to the homeland were the ones of which he was the most proud. More than a few acts of terror had been thwarted on foreign soil before they had a chance to take flight. He was never a fan of the PSD mission. Reese preferred to be on offense, taking the fight to the enemy rather than standing next to a politician with what was essentially a target painted on their back. The year of training he had recently completed at the farm built on the lessons he had learned in the SEAL teams. The CIA was all about their SDRs. Using the SDR techniques had become second nature. They augmented his proficiency acquired through operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Mozambique, Albania, Ukraine, and Russia. That real-world experience was enhanced with the scenarios they'd put him through at Camp Peary. He knew that to execute his current mission successfully, he'd need an entire team conducting both physical and technical surveillance to build a pattern of life and confirm they were targeting the correct individual. With that information, they could then decide upon the time and place of the elimination. Then why was Reese driving to Chicago alone? He needed time to think.
The President of the United States has asked you to complete a mission. You could say no.
Or was saying no not an option? Reese had raised his right hand to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Protect and defend the Constitution. Protect and defend. What are you doing, Reese? You are protecting the country you swore to defend.
Are you?
Or are you an instrument of vengeance, the personal assassin for the most powerful man in the world? Are you working for the very government that had a part in killing Lauren and Lucy? Are you doing this to avenge the attacks of 9/11? Attacks that would pull the country into a 20-year war and see your friends and teammates die in battle? Are you doing this to prevent a future attack? Or are you doing this so that the President of the United States will owe you a favor? Is this about getting the support you need to kill Nizar Khatan, the sniper who put a bullet through Freddie Strain? Are you doing this so you can use the power of the executive branch to decipher the letter your father left you? The letter you found the night you called Vic Rodriguez and agreed to join the ranks of the CIA's paramilitary branch? Or are you doing this because all you know is the kill? Later, focus on this mission. These terrorists helped plan 9/11, Reese. They could be planning future attacks. 20 years later. What are you, Reese? A soldier, an intelligence operative, a hunter of men, an assassin? You told the president you would do it. For God and country. God and country.
As the truck pushed westward, Reese convinced himself that what he was about to do would bring justice to those who had perpetrated the most devastating attack on the United States in modern times. The Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor before Hawaii was even a state. They had bombed military targets. The Twin Towers were not a legitimate military target. Deliberately targeting civilians was the very definition of terrorism. Reese thought of all those who had jumped to their deaths rather than face the prospect of being burned alive. Fathers and mothers, sons and daughters, brothers and sisters. All they had done was go to work one sunny Tuesday in September. He thought of the president's fiancée. Had she jumped? Had she perished of smoke inhalation? Had she been burned alive? Had she been trampled to death in a stairwell? Or had she died in darkness, hunkered in the corner of an office as the North Tower imploded around her? The president would never know. No one would ever know. But there was something he could do about it now. The animals who attacked the nation deserved what was coming, regardless if one day had passed since that fateful morning or 20 years. The president thought so, too. There was a reason he'd issued a presidential directive, notifications based on the authorization for the use of military force. These were legitimate military targets. Though it was not clear that they posed an imminent threat, it was not clear that they did not, either. They needed to be removed from the battlefield so that they could not be used to enable further attacks. The president was sending a message, one that would not be broadcast on cable news channels, but one that would be received by the terrorist network loud and clear. Chapter 18. Chicago, Illinois. Ali would have preferred to spend a few more days in the area, but time did not allow for that luxury. Out of necessity, he had taken a circuitous route to Chicago, borrowing Sebastian's Subaru. He first drove to Richardson, Texas, just outside Dallas, where he met with a man named Mahan Faramand, a sleeper agent of the regime. Ali had passed him the delivery mechanism and specified his objectives. First, multiple restaurants and grocery stores. Then, 2 days later, a hospital in Richardson. It was imperative they target hospitals. Timing the releases was critical. The green Subaru would undoubtedly be caught on video at some point in the journey. Avoiding every camera in the western United States was an impossibility. So Ali was going to use the power of the surveillance state to his advantage. If an enterprising investigator or intelligence officer began to put the pieces together, it would lead back to a radicalized virology student in Denver. He had then driven back to Colorado, returned the Subaru, and passed a second device to an asset in Denver. The operation was in motion, and nothing could stop it. He'd studied the Colorado asset for 2 days to confirm that the intelligence he'd been sent by Hafez Qasem through a local mosque was indeed true. He was a true believer. They'd met in Cheeseman Park, across from the Denver Botanic Gardens, where Ali had explained the simple instructions to a man who had 2 weeks left to live. Again, public locations followed by hospitals were the key. Though they didn't know it, as soon as they depressed the plungers on the CO2 cartridges, releasing Marburg variant U into the atmosphere, they were as good as dead. No loose ends. Ali had given them 2 special inoculation pills and told them to wear N95 masks as an added precaution. In actuality, the pills were 2 tablets of vitamin D from Walgreens, and the masks would do nothing to stop the aerosolized 5 to 20 micron droplets, each one containing 100 viral strands of the deadly pathogen. They would strike a blow for Allah and would die martyrs. The delivery mechanism had been designed by the Iranian and Russian scientists at Damghan, a bioweapons research facility about 185 miles east of Tehran. Disguised as a bottle, it looked like a piece of trash. All the asset needed to do was press down on a handle that resembled a Korovin, a wine bottle sampling and preservation device that used a needle and argon gas cartridge to tap wines without removing the cork. A needle powered by a cartridge containing the gas would puncture a rubber seal on a small glass vial inside the bottle, aerosolizing the virus and forcing the liquid to rapidly deploy through a nanofiber mesh filter to produce a vaporized cloud of droplets. The resulting whitish-yellow puff contained billions of viral particles. Released through a ventilation system, it could infect entire shopping malls, office buildings, or in this case, hospitals, in minutes. With most contagious viruses like COVID-19 or H1N1, thousands of viral particles need to be inhaled or touched and transferred to the nose or mouth to initiate the infection. Marburg was in a league of its own. As little as one or two viral particles were enough to contaminate a host. A single droplet from an aerosolized spray would generate a fatal illness with an incubation period of less than 48 hours. Death would follow within days. It was vital that the attack not look like an attack at all. Though Marburg was not airborne, as the American press liked to call viruses that could be spread with a cough, it was imperative that they believe it was. It needed to look like it had originated in Angola, the result of a naturally occurring hemorrhagic virus the Americans were always making movies and writing books about. The infidels never did anything other than confirm it was contained on a continent they largely ignored. All they really cared about was that African diseases stayed in Africa. What made this outbreak different was that it had made it to the homeland and had gone airborne, or so they would believe. They would connect the dots from Cabinda in northern Angola to the 4 de Febrero International Airport in the capital to a flight landing in the United States. Ali needed at least two of the four target cities to be hit with the same infection. The virus would be traced to Angola, a country with a history of infectious tropical diseases. The most sophisticated intelligence agencies in the world would never trace it back to Iran. Of course, never was a word that made Ali cringe. Every plan needed a contingency. If the U.S. intelligence community did discern that the virus was not a naturally occurring disease, it would be traced back to homegrown terrorists inspired by what the talking heads like to call an ideology of hate. That Sebastian Phillips had grown up in the United States and worked in a university bio lab would only fuel the conspiracies. With COVID-19 having dominated the news cycle for so long, most of the country had at least heard the very real possibility that the coronavirus had first originated in a Chinese biocontainment facility in Wuhan. Either way, regardless of whether the United States traced the virus to Angola or if they discovered it was released into the environment by a terrorist organization made up of U.S. citizens, the result of an airborne pathogen with the infection and death rates of Marburg was the same. The only choice was for the United States government to release the antibodies that would destroy it. In this case, those antibodies were on standby in Hurlburt Field, Florida. MC-130s armed with the largest non-nuclear payloads ever developed. To save the country from an invisible virus, the United States would have no choice but to attack itself and incinerate the disease threatening to destroy the entire nation. As with a host whose immune system attacks an invading cancer, oftentimes that host did not survive. The United States was already on edge from COVID-19 and had almost destroyed their economy for a virus that was actually doing them a favor, killing off the weak. Pulling to the curb 3 blocks from his meeting location, Ali put the car in park and looked at 2 small children playing in the front yard of a house across the street. The home was neglected and the yard full of weeds, but the smiles on the children's faces were no different than the smiles of children the world over. An older boy looked on, possibly their brother, tasked with keeping an eye on them in this neighborhood just outside Chicago. He was about the same age Ali had been when he'd found his brother swinging from the noose, eyes bulging, tongue protruding from the left side of his mouth, a casualty of war. The wailing of his mother. Ali had been told that the asset in Chicago had been unreliable in his communications. The imam had expressed concerns. There were indications that the asset had been corrupted by Western values. There were no signs that he had been contacted by American law enforcement or intelligence officers, but one could never be too certain. Ali would be the arbiter of his fate. Chapter 19. The door opened, and Karim Talib looked suspiciously through the crack, a thin chain linking the door to the frame.
Salam,
Ali said with a disarming smile.
Salam, Tijori,
the smaller man replied.
I'm well, Karim. May I come in?
Ali said, switching from Farsi to English.
Of course,
Karim responded, bowing his head and pushing the door closed to disengage the chain barrier before holding it open for his guest. He had been expecting the visitor.
Muchaker hastam. Are your wife or children home?
Ali asked.
No, they are at the park. I don't expect them for another hour. Good. Let's talk, Karim. May I have some tea?
Manre Bilkash, yes,
Karim said, nervously putting his hand to his heart.
Please follow me.
Ali trailed behind the shorter man down a hallway and into a small kitchen with aging linoleum floors. As Karim filled a pot with water and set it on the electric coil stove, Ali pulled a photo from a magnet on the refrigerator.
Is this your family, Karim?
Yes, my wife and two sons.
They are handsome boys,
Ali noted.
How old are they?
4 and 6.
You seem too old to have such young children.
My first wife died in childbirth. Our daughter did not survive. I did not remarry for many years.
I am sorry, Karim. Even the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, lost 6 of his 7 children.
They await, and I will see them again on the day of recompense,
Karim whispered, placing a mesh strainer into a small ceramic blue teapot.
Ah, that you will, Karim. Allah will ensure you will once again be at peace.
Karim nervously watched as his guest examined the photos and drawings on the refrigerator and inspected the small living area just off the kitchen.
How do you like your tea?
Strong, Karim. Do you know why I am here?
Karim's hand quivered, some of the boiling water spilling down the side of the teapot as he poured the hot liquid over dried leaves and rose petals.
I was told only to expect you, that you would have a job for me.
Not just any job, Karim. A mission from Allah.
Ali watched his subject cover the teapot.
We will let it steep for about 5 minutes.
I understand you have not been to your mosque in quite some time, Karim.
It is best not to be noticed coming and going from mosques in Chicago. The American agents are everywhere.
Ali folded his arms. Chicago had one of the fastest-growing Muslim populations in the country. Close to 500,000 children of Allah called the Windy City home, and 15 new mosques had been built in the past decade. Chicago was not a city where a Muslim would have a hard time blending in.
Have the American authorities ever tried to contact you?
No. As far as I can tell, I am still clean.
Ah, I see. And where do you and your family practice salat?
Ali asked, referring to the 5 daily prayers that were the second pillar of Islam. He intentionally looked down the hall and into the living room. Karim slowly removed 2 clear glass teacups from the cupboard and set them on the counter, gathering his thoughts.
Has faith left your heart, Karim?
Karim drew in a deep breath and whispered,
No,
with as much emotion as he could muster.
Have you not come to terms with what you did for Allah?
Karim pushed his hands together in an attempt to steady them.
Here, let me help,
Ali offered, gesturing to the small kitchen table where his host reluctantly took a seat. The assassin took charge and poured a splash of tea into both cups to warm them and check the brew for consistency. Judging the tea was strong enough for his liking, he then poured them back into the pot before filling both cups to the halfway point, adding a dash of hot water to each. Karim did not notice the small, wax-infused wafer that his visitor slid into his cup. It dissolved immediately, and Ali placed the steaming hot liquid in front of his asset.
Merci,
Karim said, thanking his unwelcome caller, thinking back to the day his adopted country was attacked, an attack he had helped facilitate, an attack that occurred on the day his wife died in childbirth. September 11th, 2001.
Khahesh Mikunam,
Ali responded.
Why are you nervous, Karim? Allah has chosen you to finish what you started 20 years ago.
Karim took a sip of the dark tea to steady his nerves.
Please.
His voice trailed off.
If you are no longer devoted to the cause, I can understand that, Karim. You have a nice life here in Chicago. Do you want me to leave?
I am not the person that I was. Allah now has a different calling for me. To raise my 2 sons. I am sorry.
I am sorry too, Karim.
Karim felt his pulse begin to race. He looked into the eyes of the man who he now knew had decided to kill him. He gazed back into his tea, struggling to focus, feeling an unnatural sweat beginning to permeate his glands.
How do you feel, Karim? You do not look well.
Ali had used the technique before. In Europe, he had concentrated natural-occurring regulatory neuropeptides that control stress, emotions, and arousal into high doses, doses large enough to cause heart attacks, seizures, and strokes. He had looped the DNA sequences into a simple bacterial culture for delivery via spray or wafer. It was completely undetectable in an autopsy, as peptides are so efficiently metabolized by the body that they are gone seconds after absorption. The concoction had sent more than a few enemies of Iran to paradise. Karim looked at Ali in horror as his body began to react to the overdose of neuropeptides. As he struggled to breathe, the cold sweat was replaced by a bout of nausea. His chest felt like it was being crushed by an invisible block of iron. His vision blurred and he made a feeble lunge for the kitchen counter, knocking over his tea before collapsing to the floor. Ali took a sip of the dark liquid. He would have preferred it stronger. He crossed his legs and watched as Karim struggled to breathe on the dirty linoleum tile. He waited another 5 minutes after Karim had stopped breathing and finished his tea. He then washed out his cup in the sink using a paper towel to turn on and off the water, and also to dry out his cup, before replacing it in the cupboard. He then exited the home and walked the 3 blocks back to his car. Chicago would be spared. No matter. This contingency had been built into the plan. Ali had another city to visit. He made his way out of Chicago and merged onto I-65. Setting his cruise control to the speed limit, he drove south toward Atlanta. Chapter 20. Chicago, Illinois. Reese had done one drive-by of the Target house and then circled back onto West Devon Avenue, passing a Dunkin' Donuts, a Domino's Pizza, a tobacco shop, a Honda dealership, a hookah lounge, and, ironically, the Iraqi Mutual Aid Society, located within a stone's throw of the Tel Aviv Kosher Bakery. This one street on the outskirts of Chicago was a multicultural microcosm of American society, where Italian, Mexican, and Chinese restaurants shared the street with Lahore Food and Grill and the Salvation Army. He passed a synagogue, a mosque, and a church within blocks of one another. Driving by a business awning signage that read Baghdad Hair Salon, he did a double take and almost missed his turn, flashing back to a mission on the streets of Iraq's capital city in a thin-skinned Humvee. The West Ridge neighborhood of Chicago was far enough outside the loop that it had been spared the rioting and looting of the previous summer. Reese couldn't help but think how much better the country might be without politicians stoking the coals of division. They excelled at stirring up hate and discontent to advance partisan political agendas in an attempt to persuade their voting blocs that they were the answer to the very problems they were creating.
Those who sell the panic sell the pill. Those politicians might be responsible for more deaths than your target, Reese.
The former frogman was acutely aware that his Land Cruiser stood out. He could have gotten away with it in a few California seaside surf communities or the back roads of the Pacific Northwest, or a ski town in the Wasatch or Rockies. But in suburban Chicago, vintage off-road vehicles were not the order of the day. If he was going to go through with this mission, he would need to do it right. That meant a team. It meant indigenous vehicles. It meant technical and physical surveillance. It meant building a pattern of life and getting creative with the method of termination.
Then what the hell are you doing here?
Reese's attention was drawn to a woman descending the steps of the small single-story home with two young children in tow. He watched them disappear down the street and found himself thinking of Lauren and Lucy, walking to the park in Coronado together. Beauty, innocence, and hope shattered at the business end of an AK. Shifting his focus back to the house, Reese wondered if his target was inside.
Am I about to do to this family what was done to mine at the behest of the same government? According to the file, this man facilitated 9/11, Reese. He deserves what's coming. Justice.
Justice?
Or retribution?
Just over 20 years ago, Karim Talib had lived in Florida. He'd taken flying lessons at Huffman Aviation in 1999, but dropped out well before he'd completed the 35 hours required for a private pilot's license certification. He was not a U.S. citizen at that point and had moved to Chicago shortly thereafter. A year later, Muhammad Atta, Ziad Jarrah, and Marwan al-Shehi applied for training. Talib had conducted what was known in special operations circles as an advance force operation. He had confirmed that a dark-skinned Muslim on a student visa could apply for flight training in the United States without getting a visit from the FBI. By all indications, Talib had been living his life as a U.S. citizen for almost two decades without any negative interaction with law enforcement or U.S. intelligence agencies. Had he reformed? Or was he just biding his time, waiting for his next assignment? That was not Reese's department. This man was a foreign agent, responsible for the deaths of almost 3,000 Americans, citizens with families and dreams, just like Lauren and Lucy. His actions had forfeited his right to citizenship. It was time for him to die. The man who knocked on the door to the home wearing what most people still called a COVID mask could have been anyone, a friend, relative, neighbor, or business associate. He spoke briefly to the man who opened the door and then disappeared inside.
Shit! I should have had my phone ready, or even better, had a high-resolution camera with a zoom lens. Rookie!
20 minutes later, the man reemerged alone and casually made his way down the street, away from Reese's position. The camera on Reese's iPhone wasn't bad, but it was not made for taking surveillance photos through windshields at over 100 yards. Something about the way the man moved put Reese on edge. He'd seen it in the instructors at the farm, men and women who had been trained to blend in while still remaining situationally aware in non-permissive environments. He took a burst of photos and resisted the urge to follow the visitor.
Stay on target.
Reese forced down a sip of coffee from the 26-ounce Yeti Rambler in the seat next to him. The mini-mart where he'd filled up hadn't had any honey, so he'd been forced to substitute with artificial sweeteners and French vanilla creamer. Reese made a mental note to dig out his Black Rifle coffee travel kit and keep it in his vehicle. The woman and children returned around noon. Less than 10 minutes later, the first police car arrived. Reese continued to snap pictures with his phone as a fire truck roared down the street and came to a stop in front of the Target house, an ambulance and another police cruiser close behind. The paramedics entered the home with two large medical packs as two EMTs pulled a wheeled stretcher from the back of the ambulance and maneuvered it inside.
What the fuck is going on? Reese wondered.
In less than 5 minutes, the medical team reemerged with a body strapped to the gurney. They loaded the patient into the back and sped off with sirens blaring. Moments later, the woman and children rushed down the steps and into an aging Civic, taking off after the ambulance. Reese exited his vehicle and approached a police officer who was talking to a firefighter.
"Hey, guys," Reese said, holding up his marshal badge. "I was just driving by. What happened?"
"Heart attack,"
the officer responded.
That's too bad,
Reese said.
Will he make it?
The officer looked to the firefighter, who shook his head.
He's gone.
We still rushed them to the hospital as a matter of protocol. He'd only been out for 30 minutes or so. Probably could have saved him if he'd been able to call 911.
Did the wife find him?
Reese asked.
Kids found him first. Always tough.
Reese contemplated telling the cop that he'd seen a man leave the house just minutes before the family had returned, but that would have led to additional questions. Reese had already pushed it enough.
So rough, Reese agreed. You guys stay safe. Thanks for holding the line.
You too, deputy.
Reese crossed the street and walked back toward his cruiser. There is no such thing as a coincidence was a popular saying in spy novels and movies. In real life, Reese knew that coincidence was a real thing. That is why it was a defined term.
Then what is this? Who is the man who arrived just prior to Talib's family returning?
Had he killed the first target on Reese's list? Though he knew it was a fruitless effort, Reese took his time getting out of town, slowly weaving his way through the surrounding streets on the off chance he might see the man in the mask. Still perplexed by the mysterious visitor, Reese turned south onto the interstate toward the next name on his list. Chapter 21. Charlie Crimmins hadn't expected Reese to bolt out of town. They certainly had not expected him to drive from Virginia to Illinois, but the tracking device they'd attached to his Land Cruiser allowed them to stay far enough back so as not to be noticed. Reese's sudden road trip could be the incentive Masada leadership needed to approve installing audio and visual recording devices in that reporter's bedroom, where Reese and Katie spent a lot of their time. Crimmins was looking forward to that assignment. He switched driving duties with his partner, a former police officer from Ohio who had been removed from the force after a suspect died in his custody. He had already been on thin ice after one too many excessive force complaints. No charges were filed because the one and only witness was dead. After a stint as a bouncer at a local strip club, he'd been hired on with Masada and completed a 3-month contract in Afghanistan and another in Colombia. The cocaine habit he'd picked up on guard duty in South America only fueled the delusions he had of himself as a special operations warrior, now having spent time in the Stan, as he liked to call it. That his experience there consisted of manually opening and closing a compound gate was not something anyone needed to know.
Woody, Crimmins said to the former police officer in the back of the minivan. He's still parked?
Huh?
Crimmins turned around and looked into the heavily modified passenger section of the dark minivan.
Put that bullshit gun porn down and pay attention, Crimmins snapped.
Woody threw his recoil magazine to the side and refreshed the screen on the monitor.
Still there, boss, Woody said. What the fuck is this guy doing here? Think he's got some strange on the side?
Quit thinking about pussy. He's got that smoker of a reporter in D.C. He's out here for something else.
Is Sawyer going to have us whack him or what?
We are going to do as we are told.
Fuck, man. I hope we get to ice him. It's been too long. I got my blaster right here, Woody said, tapping the appendix holster. Terran Tactical Glock, John Wick version.
Crimmins could only listen to so much from the wannabe super soldier.
I'm hungry, Crimmins said. I'll take over for you. Why don't you run back to that kebab place we passed a couple blocks back and pick me up a tandoori chicken?
Fuck that Hodge shit. Had enough of that in the sandbox.
First of all, you didn't do shit in the sandbox. Secondly, it's Indian food. And thirdly, you can go wherever you like, but you'll grab me a tandoori chicken.
Fuck. You want a drink?
Woody asked, moving his steroid-assisted bulk into the front passenger seat. Dr. Pepper and have him throw in some... His order was interrupted by a siren. Crimmins watched in the side-view mirror as a police cruiser sped past and turned onto the street, where their tracking device pinpointed James Reese.
Where's he going?
Crimmins wondered aloud.
Aw, man, I miss that rush, Woody said.
probably going to smash some skulls.
A fire truck, ambulance, and another police car passed in close succession. What else you want with that Hodge food? Forget it. Get in the back. Hit the recorders. Woody maneuvered into the commander's swivel chair in the back, which allowed him access to the technical surveillance equipment that lined one side of the van. We're good, he confirmed. Glad that the equipment was almost idiot-proof, Crimmins started the engine and slowly merged onto the street. Doing a drive-by with the Maryland plates was a risk. Thankfully, he'd already requested another Masada team to assist with surveillance. A second vehicle in the rotation would help keep them from getting burned.
Target vehicle still hasn't moved, Woody said.
Roger. Crimmins turned onto the street and immediately identified the emergency response vehicles in front of a home just down the road from their target vehicle. He recognized Reese talking to a police officer and firefighter in front of the house and continued to drive past, collecting 360-degree video. He drove four more blocks before pulling over.
What the fuck was that about, boss?
Not sure. Keep an eye on that monitor. Let me know if he moves. Crimmins pulled a phone from his pocket, selected a name, and brought it to his ear. Eric Sawyer listened to the report.
Send me the address and stay on him, he ordered before ending the call.
The address appeared in his messages a moment later. Sawyer forwarded it to an assistant and, within minutes, had a name and criminal history from a publicly available background check. Sawyer picked up his encrypted Crypt-All secure mobile phone, which was used to communicate only with people who owned the same devices, and placed a call. Senator Thwaite answered immediately.
What do you have for me?
He asked.
James Reese drove to Chicago. He parked outside a house owned by a man named Kareem Tlaib, a naturalized U.S. citizen with no criminal record.
And?
And? Kareem Tlaib died of a heart attack while Reese was parked outside. That gives me next to nothing. If I were you, Senator, I'd use your contacts at whatever government agency owes you a favor and find out all you can about Kareem Tlaib.
The senator terminated the call and did just as he was told. Chapter 22. Atlanta, Georgia. Sohrab Behzad was still security conscious, not just because of what he had done, but because of what he continued to do. Emigrating from Morocco in the early 90s, drawn to Nevada by the low cost of living and growing Muslim population, Sohrab's father had started his American dream as a cab driver. He soon had to quit because of the distasteful practice the company had of long-hauling tourists to cheat them for a higher fare. That and dropping drunks at strip clubs ran counter to his beliefs. A failed rental property business followed, and for a short time he drove a trailer advertising scantily clad escorts up and down Las Vegas Boulevard until he could no longer stomach it. Speaking fluent French, English, and Arabic, his wife found a good-paying job at one of the upscale hotels and acted as an interpreter when the various princes from the kingdom and other parts of the Middle East rented out the penthouse suites for a week of sin. Her work paid for close to 2 years of schooling at a local community college for her husband, who learned the art and science of stenography. When he graduated, he could transcribe more than 200 words per minute and was hired on at the Las Vegas Municipal Court Criminal Division. The elder Behzad was proud of the life he carved out for his family in the land of opportunity. For the teenage Behzads, the Mecca of sin provided other temptations. Sohrab had been young in the spring and summer of 2001 and had already spent time in the Clark County Juvenile Detention Center for possession with intent to sell. His older sister had been disowned by their parents, the lure of the Vegas Strip proving stronger than the teachings of Allah. It was her pimp who had introduced Sohrab to the drugs. The money and women that came with them were hard to resist. It wasn't easy being a Muslim so near to the gambling, fornication, and gluttony of Sin City. The Behzads lived 15 minutes from downtown, a distance that proved not far enough. There was only a single mosque when his parents had arrived from Morocco, and they raised their children to be stringent adherents of the faith. When Sarab's sister had been brought before the judge as part of a prostitution sting operation, his father dutifully took notes as a court reporter. When he returned home that evening, they had boxed up all her belongings and removed them from the house, stacking them by the garage. She had picked them up a week later with a strange man, who loaded them into a lowered van. Her mother watched from the window, but her father refused to even look at her. All her photographs were discarded, and she was never spoken of again. Sarab continued to sell drugs at his high school. He was paid in sexual favors by the pimp's prostitutes and given money that to a 17-year-old kid seemed like a fortune. All the while, he continued to go to the mosque and pray with the men. He wasn't yet ready to be kicked from the nest. His parents did not disown him, as they had his sister when he returned from the juvenile detention facility. He had found a deeper connection to Allah while incarcerated, which they saw as a blessing. His time in the state-run facility had two unintended results. He had learned to fight with improvised weapons, and he had been recruited. It was rumored that the imam from their mosque in the Vegas suburbs had fought the Soviets in Afghanistan, but he didn't look like a battle-hardened warrior to Sarab. When the imam called upon him one evening after prayers, he had expected a lecture on the dishonor his criminal activity had brought to his family. Instead, they discussed worldwide Muslim persecution. The same country that had locked him up for a minor drug offense was actively murdering Muslims across the globe at the behest of the Jews. The respected imam had given him a mission. Four men would be coming to Las Vegas, and Sarab would be their guide. It was important that they not attract attention. He was to provide them with a list of hotels and internet cafes with no security cameras, and he was to help them get around while they were in town. If Sarab was successful, the imam would have further assignments. Assignments that paid. In exchange, Sarab would have to swear to Allah that he would stop selling drugs. The four men visited Las Vegas six times over the next few months. Each time, Sarab did his duty. They were not interested in strippers, gambling, or cocaine. Instead, they stayed to themselves, meeting in the dirty rooms of shitty motels in the seedier sections of the city just off the strip. They also spent long hours in the Cyber Zone Cafe. It was Sarab's responsibility to make sure they could get to and from their destinations in a way that wouldn't attract attention. That, and teach them how to fight. They wanted to learn the skills Sarab had acquired in jail. They were particularly interested in training with box cutters. Sarab adapted what he'd learned as a ward of the state. He taught them how to use the short-bladed cardboard cutting tools as instruments of death. He didn't think it unusual when he saw Muhammad print off flight schedules in the cyber cafe. Nor did he think much of it when he drove them to the Hoover Dam. He did find it strange when the one called Marwan wanted to move to the St. Louis Manor. Only after the attack did Sarab realize that the new hotel put him a block from the Stratosphere, the tallest building in Vegas. In the days following September 11th, he saw their pictures on the news. Mohammed Atta, Hani Hanjour, Marwan al-Shehi, and Ziad Samir Jara. Rather than disgust or guilt, he felt a power. He was a warrior of Allah. He walked with a newfound swagger. He trained harder in the ring and in the weight room, feeling a great sense of pride when the hookers commented on his physique. Sarab stuck to his schedule after the attacks, continuing to work out at the boxing gym, pray at the mosque, and smoke weed with prostitutes. He kept his word and never sold drugs again. Using them was another story. When the imam called him to his office, he did not mention the men who were now known the world over as the 9/11 hijackers. Instead, he offered Sarab another job. The mosque would recommend him for employment with the Islamic Relief Society of America. One of their objectives was to provide security to mosques in the United States and Canada. They would train him as a safety and security operations officer, even bringing in the Arab American Police Association to conduct a seminar titled Protecting Our Places of Worship. Violent anti-Islamic backlash was expected as part of the fallout from the attacks, and mosques needed to be prepared. Sohrab accepted. Without leaving his adopted country, he could be a warrior for the faith. Almost two decades later, Sohrab was one of the leading experts on mosque security in the United States. His skills had improved over the years as he added Brazilian jiu-jitsu and firearms training to his regimen of boxing and weightlifting. The Islamic Relief Society sent him around the country conducting mosque vulnerability and risk assessments, writing armed carry authorization policies, providing emergency medical training, developing active threat engagement strategies, instructing de-escalation courses, and teaching incident response and crisis management. His favorite days were those training staff and volunteers for what were now called active shooter scenarios. After a day of force-on-force UTM paint cartridge training, he was ready for a night of ganja and female companionship. The dating apps on his phone made it so much easier to connect to call girls in the cities he visited across the country. He liked to end his seminar with sex he paid for. He favored the transactional nature of the relationship. He could fuck them and kick them out, just like his parents had abandoned his sister. All these years after the planes had hit, Sohrab felt the same power he had when he'd first seen the four martyrs on TV. He imagined them using the box cutters to slice the throats of the pilots, some of whom had military experience and had probably bombed innocent Muslims in the Middle East. He pictured the sharp razors at the throats of the whore flight attendants. He was proud of the skills he'd taught the martyrs. Sohrab was more energized now than he had been in years. The imam at the Atlanta mosque had passed him a message. He was to have a meeting. He was to receive a mission. That excited him. He might spend a little extra on a hooker tonight. Maybe keep her for a few extra rounds before getting rid of her. The warrior in him preferred to wake up alone. Chapter 23. Atlanta, Georgia. Reese had taken his time with this one. The file detailed the target's background in security. Never underestimate your opponent. Sohrab Behzad took different routes from the extended stay hotel to the mosque in East Atlanta. That indicated he was taking precautions. He spent each day in the mosque with a lunch break between his morning and afternoon training sessions. Reese was staying in the same hotel, which allowed him to access camera locations, entry and exit points, and study the doors and locks. Making entry to rooms with electronic door locks was much easier than hotel chains wanted guests to realize. At the farm, Reese had been taught how to surreptitiously enter and exit hotel rooms, bypassing the electronically coded RFID key cards. That would have been the way he made entry but for the camera at the end of the hallway. Instead, the sliding glass door that opened onto an absurdly small balcony would be his way in. Reese had practiced breaking into his own room from the balcony, a fairly simple procedure that called for lifting the door from its tracks with his Dynamis Combat flathead while pulling the door open with his free hand. It was possible that his target had put an obstruction in the base of the slider, and if so, Reese would regroup and continue surveillance. He wouldn't know until he tried. Reese had built a pattern of life on his targeted individual over the past few days. Sohrab had been getting back to his room late each night between midnight and 1 o'clock a.m. Tonight, Reese would be waiting. The third-story room was obscured from view of the highway by large trees that also helped dampen the noise of freeway traffic. There were no cameras observing that particular side of the four-story structure, and the curtains were pulled in the two rooms he would have to bypass on his way to the third floor. Having checked out of his room the day before Reese pulled his Land Cruiser onto a side street away from the outdoor hotel parking lot, in a position to observe the area. There were no lights illuminating the two rooms he would climb past on his way to the third-level terrace. He could see the approach to the hotel and noted that his target had not returned earlier than expected. At 11 o'clock p.m., Reese moved from his vehicle, down the street and across a grass and tree-studded park, to the edge of the hotel. After pausing to ensure a late-night walker had not compromised his approach, he climbed to the edge of the first-floor railing and jumped, pulling himself up onto the second-floor veranda. Once again, he stopped to look and listen. Confident he had not been discovered, he heaved himself up and onto the balcony of his target. He knelt down, out of sight, and listened, closing his eyes to further enhance his sense of hearing. Nothing. He gave it a full 2 minutes before moving to the sliding glass door, being sure to stay low and out of sight. He jammed the sturdy flathead into the lower portion of the tack, pushing down on the tool to leverage the door out of its track while yanking it open with his left hand. It pulled free of its safety catch, and Reese entered the room.
"What the hell is he doing in Atlanta?"
Crimmins wondered. They had been on Reese for almost a week, and Crimmins didn't know how much longer he could put up with his partner, whom he'd nicknamed Worthless Woody. Reese had checked into the extended stay hotel, far enough outside the trendy Buckhead area to keep the price down. It was an inexpensive option for those unwilling to pay the $500 a night prices of the hotels near the bars, restaurants, and nightlife of the uptown commercial district. It catered to road crew, construction teams, families on cross-country road trips, and cheating spouses looking for a discreet midday rendezvous, an illicit fling during an extra-long lunch break. The two Masada teams were staying at the Westin and kept tabs on their prey electronically. The crews rotated every 8 hours, with the on-duty team setting up across Peachtree Road in a mall parking lot, where they could change positions periodically without attracting too much attention. Though they didn't have eyes on, they were in a position to follow their target when he left the hotel, which he did each morning, taking one of three different routes to East Atlanta. Their surveillance notes indicated he spent much of his time in his vehicle around the Atlanta Masjid of Al-Islam Mosque.
"What are you up to, you son of a bitch?"
Their target's movements coincided with another guest at the hotel, a man driving a mid-sized rental car who appeared to be